Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Obviously, these are not good times. But again, I thought our guys in the first half, I thought they fought hard. I thought the defense did a good job of keeping them out of the end zone. I didn't think we played well on offense at all. I think we got to get better. I take responsibility for that. We got to make more plays. We got to do a better job of finding a way to score. You know, this part of the season, there's some things that I thought maybe we start getting better at, and it looks like we're still not there yet. We still got a ways to go, and I know that, and I can see it.
Stafford takes the snap, goes on the end around to Ebron, to the one, to the end zone, touchdown Detroit Lions. Why not? He took it all the way down there, and then he took it home. The Lions have the lead back. 8 seconds to go, maybe the final play of the game. Bortles has got it, sets in the pocket, throws over the middle. It is behind his intended receiver and picked off. The Lions have it. They slide down. It is Tavon Wilson with the ball. Put it away, folks. Win number 6 for the Lions.
On offense, we're, you know, just struggling for yards all game. Struggling for yards, big plays, first downs, whatever it was. So we didn't play as well as we can on offense. Luckily, it's a team game, and our defense and our special teams played fantastic. You know, really helped us out with a win.
Davion Smith breaking tackles inside the 10-yard line. Smith dives. He's in. Touchdown, Michigan.
Checking to make sure that Smith did, in fact, cross the plane. Very clear that he is in the end zone.
Winning a football game is a great feeling. When you're a team and you come together and you go out and win a football game, that's a good feeling enough. Everything's a test. You know, every week is a test. Every game that you line up is a test. I mean, there's a lot of tests in lives. And life comes in many forms and fashions. Playing a really good Indiana football team, that was a huge test for us today. And we're responding, coming together as a team, gives us a great feeling. We're going to enjoy this game and then get right on in preparation for Ohio State.
And it looks like they may be going for two. Tyler O'Connor in the shotgun gets the snap. Back to throw. O'Connor looks, throws in the end zone, and it's intercepted. Chris Worley comes up with it. His second pick of the game as he stepped in front of it. The two-point try, no good. And Ohio State remains ahead by just a point, though, 17-16. O'Connor assembles the offense in a hurry. Gets the ball. Drops it as two to pass. Hit while throwing one up the right side of the field, and it's intercepted. Ohio State comes up with another pick on a ball that was thrown up the right side. And with a minute 30 to play, the Buckeyes defense comes up with another takeaway.
Tough day of the offense right there. Take the win against a team that we know very well. On the road in November, 10-1, and get ready for our rivalry week.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to a Monday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza. Right here we are. Toledo sports leader, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. We got a lot of really good stuff to talk about today. We got a lot of really good people to talk to. And, of course, none of them more important than you. Be a part of the program today whenever the urge strikes and the feeling is there for you. You got something to say if you want to yell at me about or yell at Kushlin about or agree with us about or whatever the case might be. 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. We'll get you up and on the radio. If you'd rather tweet or comment to the program on social media, you can do so on Twitter at Sports Radio 1065 and on Facebook at 1065 The Ticket. How's that sound? Remember, you got both of the little imaging liners covered there. We got you on social media as well. What an amazing weekend we just saw in college and professional football, and you know what that means, do you not? It means... Come on, Kushlin, you said you had it ready.
Grab your helmet. You're going in. It's time to play Monday afternoon quarterback on 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed time to analyze everything from the comfort of the Monday afternoon share. We can look back at everything people did yesterday and Saturday and critique it to death. Tell them how bad they were. Christian, did you or did you not say before we came on the air? Don't forget, I've got the Monday afternoon quarterback liner ready to go.
I did say that.
Yeah, well, and then where the hell were you, for crying out loud? Are you still on the weekend, or did you take off early for Thanksgiving?
No, I have not taken off early for Thanksgiving.
Oh, my goodness gracious. All right, well, Thanksgiving is just steamrolling straight ahead. And you know, the interesting part about that, obviously, is that means more NFL football is steaming straight ahead at us, and you better be ready for it. At least the Lions better be ready for it. There's three games again, right, Jim Quishlin?
Yes, yes. And we'll have them all, by the way, right here on the ticket.
That's where I was going with this. I'm sure you'd like to give a little programming note here as to the our coverage of all of the NFL games coming up on Thanksgiving Thursday. And it is going to be an awful lot of fun because there are some pretty interesting matchups. Not all of them are always the best matchups, but you do have some pretty good ones coming up on Thursday, Thanksgiving Thursday. Let's get back to yesterday, and let's get back to what happened in college football on Saturday before we start looking ahead. But I do want to look ahead to Thanksgiving Thursday NFL football. Now, yesterday, how about, and we're going to start, even though I think the Browns 0-11 is a bigger story because they are chirping at one another now, and some of the players, including, you know, newbie Terrell Pryor and old guy, meaning he has been with the franchise for so long, and one of the most respected and revered players for the Cleveland Browns, Joe Thomas. Those two guys, among others, are just about fed up with the front office management decisions that are being made on personnel, getting guys hurt because they are simply not prepared with the right personnel. It's getting ugly out there, and that could be and should be the lead story because it's a bigger story. It's a bigger deal than just one team winning a game. But considering the fact that the Detroit Lions are on a roll and they are now a winning football team, you're talking about a football team that went into the break, or not the break, but the bye week, I should say, with a little bit of momentum because of the win over the Minnesota Vikings. But now you're talking about a team that's won five of the last six games. That's not just a little bit of momentum. That's a lot of momentum. Back-to-back wins wrapped around the bye week, the win over the Vikings, now the win over the hapless Jaguars that it took a very, very dominant fourth quarter for the Lions to get. They get a win over the Jacksonville Jaguars to make it two straight, and again, five out of their last six, putting themselves squarely in position to make the playoffs, and very likely and potentially and possibly, and I don't know how many other ways I can say that, you know, as the division champion. This is the division that was supposed to be really, really difficult, and some of the teams that were supposed to be really, really good just aren't. The Packers are bad. They're bad. They've lost four straight football games to fall to 4-6. They are bad. The Minnesota Vikings that started out 5-0, they fell apart and lost four straight football games before finally getting a win this yesterday as well over the hapless Bears, who are just one of the worst teams in football, probably the worst team in football, not named the Cleveland Browns. Yeah, I don't know. 49ers give them a run, I suppose. But anyway, the Lions now sit squarely atop, even though they are tied officially at 6-4 atop the NFC North with those Vikings. The Lions are in control because they own a tiebreaker in having beaten them. Now, of course, the flip side of that is, who do they have waiting on Thanksgiving Thursday? That very same Vikings team. So an opportunity to really kind of separate themselves a little bit from the other first-place team in the division coming up on Thursday. Now, what makes yesterday's win over Jacksonville so impressive, in addition to the creativity, by the way, of giving the ball to tight end Eric Ebron in his first ever carry as a running back in the National Football League on a motion carry for the go-ahead touchdown, in addition to that creativity, what really made it impressive is that this is a day that the Lions really dominated in the fourth quarter. Now, you might say, well, they've won a lot of other games in the fourth quarter, and that's true, but they have trailed so many games in the fourth quarter, and they have given up big plays and big drives in the fourth quarter. This is a day where really the offense was stagnant for three quarters, and they needed a fourth quarter in which they shut out the opponent and put together, a few nice scoring drives, and that is exactly what they were able to do. The Jacksonville Jaguars are not the Denver Broncos. They're not the Seattle Seahawks or Dallas Cowboys. They're not one of the elite teams. I'm saying that, obviously, for the statement of the obvious, saying don't get too excited about it, but you do what you have to do against a team that allows you to do it. And that's exactly what they did yesterday. So a nice fourth quarter performance yesterday gives Jim Caldwell and the Lions a 26-19 win. They get the carry, the go-ahead touchdown from Ebron. And quite frankly, the Lions now have people asking, are they a team that could be a threat? Are they a team that could very well maybe make some noise in the National Football Conference playoffs? Read an article this morning on ESPN.com asking that very same question. Could they be one of the most dangerous teams in the NFC playoffs, or are they just a very mediocre team in a very, very mediocre and bad division? Maybe both. It is possible to be a mediocre team in a mediocre division, but win that division and then still be a dangerous out in the playoffs. If, of course, everything holds to where it is right now. And it isn't there yet, but 6-4 with six to play. And you look at that schedule as we've done time and time again on this program, trying to project out Minnesota. We know they beat them once and now you get them at home. New Orleans, they have no defense whatsoever. Matthew Stafford ought to be able to have a field day there. And you want to know why he has no defense there, or they have no defense there. Because they are the New Orleans Saints. Drew Brees and Sean Payton, they focus on offense, and that's all they focus on. I don't even know if they practice defense down there in the Big Easy. Chicago Bears, as mentioned, in week 14, they're awful. The Giants, now that's a tougher out. Giants have won five in a row on their own. I believe it's five. I don't want to swear to that, but I believe they have won five in a row. Yeah, I'm correct. They've won five in a row. They're 7-3 and looking like a serious contender in the NFC, which is a little surprising given the way things went early on this season. Then the Dallas Cowboys, who are simply, you know, football's best team right now. You hate to say, well, I don't say hate that. New England being 8-2, you know, showing a little bit of a, you know, chink in the armor last week. New England is 8-2. I think a lot of people felt like New England was the best team in football, but for me, not just because of 9-1, but in large part because of 9-1. But also just because of the way they play the game, the Cowboys are the best team in football right now. So you got them in week 16, and then you wrap it up with a Packers team that, quite frankly, as I said, is a shell of itself. It's a team much like, are you ready for what I'm about to say? It's going to sound crazy. Much like the Cleveland Browns. How are the Packers in any way, shape, or form like the Cleveland Browns? Simple. They're cracking from within. Now, the Packers are, of course, better. They have better players. They have a better quarterback. And they have a better record. But, like the Browns are starting to turn on one another and starting to call out their front office, there are Packers players, past and present, who are calling out Aaron Rodgers. That's right. The superhuman quarterback. One of the top two or three quarterbacks in the game in the last 5 years or more, as a lot of people would certainly attest. They are turning on Aaron Rodgers. So that's kind of the way it is for the Detroit Lions. As I want to start it off today. Like I said, we'll talk about the Browns coming up at 3:35. As a matter of fact, we'll go out to Cleveland and talk to Dennis Manilow about the 0-11 Browns and all of their problems. But celebrating the Detroit Lions win, a come-from-behind win, in a fourth-quarter dominating performance in which they shut out the Jaguars and put a couple of scores on the board to pull away and win that quarter 10-0, and away you go. All signs point to this team being in control of their own division destiny, Jim Cushman.
Yeah, they absolutely are. They already have the one win against the Vikings, so a win at Ford Field to start off the Thanksgiving triple header would completely give them any kind of tiebreaker over the Vikings should they need it. And to me, one of the things you just said there is one of the most impressive numbers for the Lions for me on this game yesterday. 0 points in the fourth quarter. You pointed out they outscored the Jaguars 10-0, and we haven't been able to say that the Lions defense put up a goose egg in fourth quarters many times this season.
No, not at all. That's been one of the biggest problems is in the fourth quarter they have their defense has allowed points and allowed teams to take control of games, even if their offense was able to come back in many of those occasions. Obviously, it's a 5-4 record prior to this week or prior to yesterday's win. So obviously the offense has been able to put some things together to overcome that defensive lapse, but you get a shutout now. Now, the fact that you shut out Blake Bortles, well, we'll just kind of forget about that. It's Blake Bortles. He threw two touchdowns and two interceptions in this game with a quarterback rating of 73.8. Not exactly the toughest guy to stop in the fourth quarter. But let's just take victories when you can get victories. And I don't mean on the scoreboard. I mean defensive victories. You shut out a team in the fourth quarter while putting up 10 points of your own, getting things done that needed to get done. Now, on the flip side, the one thing you do have to be concerned with, again, Amir Abdullah still has not played, and I don't know if he's coming back anytime soon. We talked to Justin Rogers a little bit about that. That's still kind of a question mark. And the running game is simply straight up non-existent. You can't win games on a regular basis with 21 carries for 14 yards. That's an average of 0.7 yards per carry. And the only touchdown run you got is from your tight end, as I mentioned, the one-yarder from Eric Ebron. So that's the one, you know, downside of this. You know, obviously the upside is Matthew Stafford is doing Matthew Stafford-type things, except for the touchdown passes yesterday. But 24 of 33, very solid, 278 yards, no touchdowns, but no picks either, a 97 rating. That's fine. You've got to add a running game to, obviously, as we talk about, you know, a defense that that did its job in the fourth quarter. What do you think, Cushlin? I mean, that's I don't want to say it's an Achilles heel, but as we get into deeper November and into December, and if you hope to play football very much into January, you're going to have to be able to run the football, especially if you get into some of the cold weather conditions, you know, that the Lions could find themselves in, and of course that they play in.
Sure, and you're absolutely right on that. And this isn't obviously a new problem for the Lions. It just isn't. We've known about this really from beginning of camp, and then you add injuries all across the line to that as well. It's just never been that good of a running game, but I completely agree. You need something. I mean, I'm looking at some of these guys. Four carries, 13 yards for Riddick, 13 and 6. That's carries, then yards for Washington, and then Ebron with the one carry, and that was the one-yard touchdown run. And as you pointed out correctly, he's basically a tight end. You need something on the running game because you won't get these kind of performances defensively all that often. I mean, you heard Matthew Stafford, his quote in the montage right there, Bob. You know, credit for this one goes out to the defense and special teams. I mean, you got a punt return touchdown. You got a pick six in this game. You shut out the Jaguars. And I know it's the Jaguars in the fourth quarter, but considering what this team is usually doing defensively on the fourth quarter, you use this as a building block. But you're right. When it all comes down to it, especially if you're in a January game, especially if it's not a dome, and you get there, you're going to need something more than what they have at running back, and I'm not sure how you get that at this point.
Yeah, excuse me, and that's what I'm talking about. You know, if you go to a cold weather city like Detroit, but obviously one that is not indoors, you are going to have to be able to run the ball because it's harder and harder to throw in the cold, swirling winds. It's not anything anybody doesn't know, but it's just something worth pointing out here in, you know, in mid to late November. Because when it gets to January and December, or December and January, I beg your pardon, if you continue to play into January very far, you're going to have to deal with that. So it's worth pointing out that the running game just does not have a solution right now for the Detroit Lions. But nonetheless, 6-4, and feeling very good, at least they should be, about their stand atop the division. They should be able to go up a game on the Vikings, which would actually be two games, because they would, of course, have the season series advantage, two games to none over them, in the event of an eventual tie. So, and then third, of course, is the Packers that just look further and further and further out of it with each passing week. Aaron Rodgers isn't telling anybody R-E-L-A-X, relax anymore, the way he did last year. Nobody's relaxing, and as a matter of fact, nobody, quite frankly, is listening to him. According to multiple people associated with the Packers, current and former players, they can't stand Aaron Rodgers and his ego and his attitude and everything else anymore. And that is just striking, considering at one time he was considered to be right there with Tom Brady and Peyton Manning before his quick decline at the end of his career as one of the top three quarterbacks in the National Football League, maybe better than those other two guys, according to some. All right, so that's where we are as far as the NFC North. I'm going to save a little bit of the AFC North conversation for our friend Dennis Maniloff, who will join us at about 3:35 after we take a time out here in just a couple of minutes. But just kind of to set the table, Terrell Pryor is a newbie in Cleveland. Terrell Pryor is a newbie as a wide receiver. He's been in the league for, you know, just a cup of coffee thus far, really. I mean, he started out a few years ago, as we know. This is his fourth year, I want to say, in the league, Jim. I want to say it's
I think four- so, but let me triple check that.
Yeah, I want to say it's his fourth year, and obviously we know it came into the league as a quarterback. Terrell Pryor did. He played with the Raiders a little bit and has kind of bounced and has been looking for a place. And he's found his home, of course, now as a...
Actually, this is his fifth year.
Fifth. Okay, fifth. Thank you. As a wide receiver and a pretty good one. Pretty good one. But my point to all of this isn't to evaluate or judge Terrell Pryor. It's to say that this is a newbie who doesn't have a whole lot of cachet, if you will, in the league. But he is joined by Joe Thomas, who has just about as much stroke as anybody could in that franchise. He's a Hall of Famer in waiting. Joe Thomas is one of the best offensive linemen of his generation, and some might argue by the time he's done of any generation, though nobody will ever know it, because he's never going to make a Super Bowl, not in Cleveland. You know, Anthony Munoz at least made a Super Bowl.
Right.
You know, you start talking about the greatest offensive tackles you've ever seen. Anthony Munoz, Orlando Pace, who just went into the Hall of Fame. You know, these guys at least had opportunities to get to championship games. Joe Thomas hasn't even been to playoffs but once in his entire career. Actually, was he on the team in 07 when they made that one playoff game?
They didn't make the playoffs. That playoff year was 02.
That was 02.
Yeah, remember, in 07 they won 10 games but lost out on the tiebreaker.
Good call. Good call. So he's never made a playoff game in his entire career with the Browns. And these two guys, a newbie and an established veteran leader, both among those getting very, very tired of the same act in Cleveland, but even worse. Terrell Pryor said after the game, in the yesterday's 24-9 loss to the Pittsburgh Steelers, quote, "This is bullcrap. We can't keep doing this, and we can't keep getting our guys hit. It's as simple as that." He was asked what the team can do about it, and immediately the newbie said, "Front office, quote, I don't know. You'd have to talk to our management. It's a question for them. We can't keep getting these guys hit. I'm tired of our guys getting hit. I'm nobody to complain because I don't run it. But it's personal to me because I care for those guys, and I don't like seeing those guys get hit. Somebody's got to say it." Now, what guys is he talking about? Well, of course, he's talking about Josh McCown, Robert Griffin III, Cody Kessler, Charlie Whitehurst, Kevin Hogan, all of the quarterbacks who have played under center for the Browns this year, all of whom have gotten hurt at some point or another or multiple times because of just an abysmal, horrific offensive line. And I think it's very, very noble, by the way, of Terrell Pryor to call this out as it is, as a former quarterback himself. He can empathize, and he knows what it's like. If you're standing there behind, you know, an offensive line that's a cheese grater, that everybody just sifts right through, then for crying out loud, he knows what it's like. So he feels for the quarterbacks. And then that takes us to Joe Thomas. Joe Thomas told our friend Scott Petrak, quote, "You've got to lie in the bed that you've made. We lost a couple really good players. I think the best at their positions. But that was our strategy in the offseason. That's what we decided to do." And if you don't know who he's talking about center Alex Mack and right tack Mitchell Schwartz, two extraordinarily important pieces to that offensive line, both of whom were let go in free agency. The guys, Thomas went on to say, that are making the personnel decisions, they're the experts on that, so they're the ones that have to make those decisions and look at those decisions when they're made. So that was a very, you know, veiled and professional way of saying, hey, off of front office, you guys are the ones killing us. You guys are the ones killing our quarterbacks and thus our chances to win football games. So things are kind of coming apart at the seams now for the 0-11 Cleveland Browns, the worst start in franchise history. They have now lost 13 games in a row, I believe, and are quite possibly, if not flat out, probably on their way to the second 0-16 season in the history of the National Football League following the 2008 Detroit Lions. So we're going to talk about that and much more in the NFL coming up as this Monday afternoon quarterback edition of the Extravaganza continues. Maniloff joins us next. You join us whenever you're ready at 866-240-1065.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we? It is 3:39. Thanks for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Got a lot of college football talk coming up in the second hour. Ohio State-Michigan week, number 2 versus number 3. The winner going into the college football playoffs almost guaranteed. The winner, if it's Michigan, into the Big Ten championship game first. That's why it's an almost guarantee. So we're going to talk a lot about that coming up with Bill Connolly of SBNation.com. But for now, let's stay on the NFL and let's talk about the most embarrassing franchise in all of professional sports in North America. And I mean every single sport in every single league. No franchise is worse than that of the Cleveland Browns. 0-11 now, and now they're starting to come apart at the seams. Players on the inside are actually calling out the front office, from established veterans to relative newcomers to Cleveland. And joining us to break it all down now is our good friend Dennis Mandeloff of the Northeast Ohio Media Group. Hey, D-Man, what's going on, brother?
You got one thing wrong, Bob.
What's that?
The Browns are the best in the league at being bad.
They are indeed that. They are indeed that. I've never seen anything really quite like what we're watching right now. And Dennis, quite like what we've seen since 1999. You know, we're talking about darn near two decades of futility. And I know it started over with an expansion team, but honestly, they are far, far more embarrassing now. And this team, in my estimation, is far, far worse now than they were when they restarted it in 1999. All things being considered, all draft picks that they have had, all top choices wasted year after year after year. And now it's all coming together in one perfect storm of futility, an 0-16 season on the horizon. What the hell's going on?
If I knew the answer to that, I would probably be running the Browns right now.
Maybe you should be.
Listen, here's the thing, Bob. What do we ask when the new regimes come in? We ask that, at least in the first year, make sure that your team looks better at the end than it does at the beginning. Let's see incremental, even if it's incremental, let's see growth. Let's see improvement. Let's see players who seem to be getting it. Okay, with the Cleveland Browns this year, Hugh Jackson comes in. I say, I'm all in on Hugh. I'm still okay with Hugh Jackson, all right? However, the problem that you're talking about, and the reason why the cracks are starting to show in the build already, is because you don't see improvement in this team. You don't see improvement necessarily in individuals. Now, some would argue those individuals can't really improve or show their level of improvement when they're surrounded by, you know, problems or schemes that are out of whack.
Sure.
But the alarming element of this team right now, in this franchise, I suppose you could say as well, is what has happened in the past three games. They have been completely outclassed by the Dallas Cowboys, the Baltimore Ravens, and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now you say, well, the Dallas Cowboys are outclassing a lot of people. You know, they've dominated since that first loss. They're winless. I mean, they haven't lost. Okay, fine. Dallas comes into your building and dominates you. It's tough to deal with. But the last two games, you're not going to tell me the Baltimore Ravens are a juggernaut, and you're not going to tell me the Steelers, who had lost four straight, are a juggernaut. And yet both of those teams just tossed the Browns aside like they were garbage. And you know, some would say that's what the Browns are. But my point is, two division rivals, oh no, I shouldn't use that word either, rivals. two division opponents, back-to-back weeks, thoroughly beat you down. I mean, it wasn't even funny. And yesterday, not only did the Steelers out-execute the Browns, but they beat them up. And that is, to me, that would be the ultimate humiliation if I'm an NFL player, to be physically overwhelmed. The Steelers were virtually targeting Browns players, teeing off on them, and the Browns are just sitting there like, oh, well, you know, that's when the build becomes alarming, when you see the stuff you've seen the last 3 weeks.
A lot of meat there to dig into.
Sorry, I didn't mean to draw
that.
Let's go
to what the Steelers are doing to them yesterday when you talk about teeing off on them. The other thing they did to them to me was they showed a disrespect for the Cleveland Browns at the end of the first half that I can't really imagine them doing to any other team. When they refused 100%. To kick the field goal at the end of the first half and said, nope, we're going for it. Nope, you got a penalty, we're going for it again. Oh, we're going to go for it again. I mean, you know, it was just one of those things where it said, we have no fear of you. We don't fear you. We don't think you can beat us. If we come away with nothing here and we go into the locker room 6-0, we don't think it'll give you any momentum. Not that you can do anything with in the second half because you're that bad. You are that inconsequential to us that we're just going to work on our goal line offense against you here 3 times, even if you continue to commit penalties in the end zone against us, until we eventually punch it in. That, to me, was from the coaching staff all the way through every player wearing black and gold yesterday, was saying, nobody else, against anybody else, we would not do this. But against these guys, let's practice. That's kind of how the vibe I got was. So they're taking shots at him in terms of play calling and decision making, as well as physical shots at him on the football field.
Oh, there's no question. It was almost as if five of the football guys were saying to the Steelers, are you sure you want to go for it on the untimed down? Are you sure you want to go for it on the untimed down and not kick the field goal? And the Steelers like, yeah, we got this. No problem.
<That's exactly laughs>
We're
going to
keep doing this until we score.
Or until we don't score. But again, we have no fear of the backlash of that because we don't think that they're going to use it to their advantage at all in the second half.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, again, this is a Steelers team that, most people had high expectations for based on their offense. But the facts are the facts. I mean, they came into the game, and I believe it was, 4-5?
4-5, yeah, 4-5.
Yeah, and had lost 4 in a row. So this was not a team that was locked in. They, you know, they were showing cracks. They were having issues. And they are not exactly the 85 Bears defensively, okay? You could say, okay, Roethlisberger and his weapons, they're dangerous offensively. But you look at the defense and the stat that Rich Gannon, the great CBS analyst yesterday, kept pointing out, you know, the sack stat. And, of course, he had to because the Steelers were piling them up left and right. The Steelers entered yesterday's game ranked tied for last in the NFL with 13 sacks. They had 8 yesterday.
And that's without Cameron Hayward. Without Cameron Hayward, the guy that the former Ohio State Buckeye that they said a lot of guys said was the heart of their defense, and in a very important part of their pass rush and their run defense, wasn't there. And what does that speak to? Well, that speaks to Dennis. We're talking to Dennis Mandeloff, Cleveland Plain Dealer, Northeast Iowa Media Group, Cleveland.com, and an author as well of From A to Z, Andrews to Zastadil. pick that book up, by the way. That speaks to what Terrell Pryor and Joe Thomas said in separate post-game interviews yesterday, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. Terrell Pryor, a relative newcomer in Cleveland, relative newcomer, quite frankly, in the league. He's in his 5th year, but now just establishing himself as a player, now that he's made the transition, of course, to wide receiver. Terrell Pryor said, quote, "This is bullcrap. We can't keep doing this, and we can't keep getting our guys hit. It's as simple as that. I don't know. He was asked about the front office. You'd have to ask our management. It's a question for them. We can't keep getting these guys hit. I'm tired of our guys getting hit. I'm nobody to complain because I don't run it, but it's personal to me because I care for these guys, and I don't like seeing those guys get hit. Somebody's got to say it." Now, that's Pryor, the relative newcomer, and then there's the statesman, Joe Thomas, the future Hall of Famer, who essentially said the same thing as he talked in the post game to our buddy, our mutual friend, yours and mine, Scott Petrak, about Alex Mack and Mitchell Schwartz both being gone, two key components of the offensive line. And what has all of that led to? Injuries to Griffin, McCown, Whitehurst, Kessler, Hogan, over and over and over again. Anybody standing under center is just, they're just getting destroyed because of that offensive line. What does it say, Dennis, that they're so openly, wantonly calling out their own front office?
That's a problem. Hey, there's no question it's a problem. And I read somewhere real briefly before I got on with you, Bob, where, you know, Hugh Jackson said in his comments today to the media that he had spoken with Joe Thomas. I mean, listen, I, I don't know what was said between those two guys, but I sure hope Jackson didn't tell Thomas to, you know, put a sock in it, because Joe Thomas has as much right as anybody in that building to speak his mind. And when he does, and he usually bites his tongue. So when he does speak his mind, it's news, okay? When he says anything negative, it's news, or that could perceive to be negative. Pryor, obviously, is emerging as one of the team leaders on this team, even though he's only been around for a short period of time.
Sure.
So he has a right to speak up. But I will say this to Pryor's point about, you know, the sacks and about the quarterbacks getting hurt. Any rational view of yesterday's game, and I did it, you know, in real time and then in DVR, when you look at the quarterback hits and you look at the sacks, there's no question that the line had protection issues and individual players got beat on certain plays. Running backs for the Browns were unable to handle the zone blitzers for the Steelers. Mm-hmm. So there was protection issues, no question about that. But certainly in the Pittsburgh game, there were also issues with Kessler and McCown not knowing what they wanted to do with the ball, which, you know, the offensive line, and if you put them on a truth serum, will say, look, you can take shots at us all you want for sacks or hits, but the quarterback has got to get rid of the ball to help us out.
Hold on. Let me throw a wrinkle into the argument you're making there right now for the offensive line. Not that you're making it, but what they might say.
Not excusing them, just saying there's other factors.
I understand.
Okay, keep going.
But here's the flip side to that, or maybe not the flip side, but just the addendum to that. The quarterbacks might say, yeah, well, guess what? If one of us was in there long enough to be able to get comfortable and to read the defenses and to have chemistry with our receivers, develop timing, we could get rid of the ball quicker, but you're getting us killed. One of us is getting knocked out every week, and it's on to the next guy in the chain. None of us have an opportunity to get better because you're getting us hit. So it's chicken and egg, very much so, I think, at this point.
Yeah, you speak to that. You're right. And it's also a perfect storm, because another element, another reason the Steelers were able to be so effective with their pass rush yesterday was because the Browns had no semblance of a running game. Okay. The Browns just don't run the ball anymore, I guess. I mean, they had a good little run situation going early in the season. That's pretty much dissipated. So the Steelers were like, and then the score dictated that all you were going to do was pass. So they didn't have to worry about the run. And, you know, even if you did gash them here or there, they felt like they could, you know, clamp it down when need be. But the Browns, you know, they made the Steelers' defense look like the 85 Bears or the 70s Steelers. And that really shouldn't have been the case. I mean, there are issues on the Steelers' defense. There are things you can exploit, and the Browns didn't even come close to doing it. But it really was a combination of factors. You had bad quarterback play with Kessler and McCown. And by the way, all I care about really where Kessler's concerned is not his grade for the game, which was a D-minus for me. I'm not giving him an F because of the concussion. You know, all I care about with him is
what grade concussion did he get?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, yeah, I mean, he went out there and did not play well, okay? But are you going to pile on a guy who's got his second concussion in a month as a rookie? No. McCown was equally bad. So you had bad quarterback play. You had terrible line play. You had terrible running backs picking up the blitz. I mean, here was the other thing that's pretty scary about. You know the Steelers, even without LeBeau, they have that zone blitz scheme that they like to run, okay, defensively. The Browns looked as though they had never seen that. They played as if they had never seen a zone blitz. They didn't know where these guys were coming from. They didn't know how to pick them up. And Rich Gannon, again, pointed out there was one, you talk about disrespect, back-to-back plays where Ryan Shazier blitzed from essentially the same spot, second-level blitz, mm-hmm. came in late, untouched. Two times in a row. And Gannon says, and the first one led to it was a strip sack that they recovered in the end zone. And then the next possession, first play, they ran the same thing. And Shazier came in and chased McCown out of the pocket and something happened. But Gannon said, they just showed you this look and they did exactly what they did the previous play, the previous time you were on the field, and you didn't handle it again. That's when you start to go, okay, what is happening here? Is it personnel that can't pick it up? Is it coaching? And I think right now, Bob, at 0-11, with all the issues surrounding this team, you have a perfect storm because everybody is to blame. There's not one area. I mean, even Pryor, you know, makes mistakes too, okay? As good as he's been for this team, everybody is to blame right now for what is going on in Berea.
Last thing, and we'll let you run here, Dennis, as you break down what happened yesterday with the Browns and the Steelers and really this season. We both agree, and I think Jim Cushlin, when we've talked about this, agrees that there's no way that Jimmy Haslam is going to let Sashi Brown or anybody else fire the coach again as we've gone through Pettine. I can't remember the order anymore between Pettine and Shurmur and for crying out loud, I can't remember his name now. Chudzinski, yeah, was the one I was going back to there. I mean, it's just happened over and over. They're averaging a new coach about every year and a half, I think, for the last 8 years. They're not going to do that, but I wonder, do you think there's a chance that Hugh Jackson makes that decision and says, I really don't want to be a part of this anymore, and walks away from it? Not being fired, but walks away from it. It would not be the first time. Who was the coach? Doug Marrone, who walked away from the Bills job. Wasn't it the Bills that he walked away from about 4 years ago, 5 years ago? He was hired, and he was what, three quarters of the way through his first season?
Well, it was actually a couple years ago, yeah. It was Marrone. Yeah.
And just, you know, I'm not getting fired, but I just don't want this job anymore. There's got to be greener pastures someplace else than what I'm dealing with here. And if it means I don't get another head job for a long time, if ever again, so be it. But I'd rather go coach somewhere else than continue in this disaster zone. Any chance that Hugh Jackson, especially if they go 0-16, says, thank you to Mr. Haslam and everything, but, you know, obviously what I'm doing isn't working, and we didn't make progress from week 1 to week 17. Let somebody else try this.
I initially wanted to say no, Bob. There's absolutely no chance that's going to happen, but in Cleveland with the Browns, anything's possible, so I suppose you could put a 1% chance on it.
That's how I'm thinking about it. I don't think it would really happen. Well, it did happen in Buffalo, so it's not an OIC with Marrone. But I hear him constantly taking the blame. This is on me. This is on me. It's not anybody else. It's on me. And that's great. That's what a leader has to do. But I wonder how long how soon before he's tired of saying it's on me and I stink at this, or having to say that publicly, even if he doesn't feel that way. But it's on me. And the rebuild here is just going to take too long. And that's the thing. And you know this, of course, as well as anybody, Dennis. This is a league that is built so that teams can go from worst to first in relatively short order. This is a team where they really give you that opportunity to progress quickly. Where there's no lottery. If you stink on ice, you're getting the best draft picks, and you're getting the best opportunities to improve yourself. And you can do it quickly. Look at what the Raiders have done since they drafted Derek Carr, Khalil Mack, Amari Cooper, and on down the line we go. This is a league in which you can turn it around quickly, and the Browns can't do it. And I just wonder at some point if somebody doesn't get so frustrated and say, I can't do it, and I don't want to be around if it's going to take 4 or 5 years in a league where it's supposed to take one or two.
Bob, I'm going to say there will be no Moss from Jackson. He is going to stick this out. Partly because of what you just said. I mean, the idea that NFL teams are, or the NFL is set up where teams can rebound quickly. I think he says, all right, if I'm going to be endure this embarrassment and this pile of losses, I want to be around when this worm turns. And I think he's confident enough in his own abilities that he's going to get it done. And that the last thing in the world he would want to do is, bail out of the plane, before some victories begin. And of course, the cynics can say, oh, then they'll never win with Cleveland. And, doesn't he realize if he gets out now, he'll be better for it in 5 years? No, that's not how Jackson's thinking. He wants to see this through. I think he has been surprised by how bad it's been. I don't think he ever in his wildest nightmares thought he was going to be 0-11. I think he's startled at how bad his team has looked lately. So there's no question that he's been, you know, shaken a little bit.
Yeah.
But I don't think that he's anywhere close to, you know, cashing out.
Well, here's what he's got in store for himself, Dennis. There are 14 draft picks that they had this past season, you know, this past draft that are playing this season. 13 of them remain on the team, and not a single one of them is a game changer, an impact player, not one. And guess what? The same guys with the same little analytics computer that Paul D. Podesta used this time around, and Sashi Brown with this extensive wealth of experience and player evaluation, the same guys get to make 12 more picks next April. So you know what? If I'm you, I'm thinking, thank God my contract is guaranteed and I get paid no matter how bad we are. You already got 24 guys under the age of 24 years old on this football team. You're about to add 12 more coming up in April. It doesn't look like it's going to get much better anytime soon out there in C-Town.
Well, I'm not saying that Hugh Jackson didn't have say in the drafting of players this past draft, but it is possible that after the season's over, Jackson says, look, you know, if I'm going to stick this thing out and I want to, I need to have a more active role in the personnel, in the acquisitions. And that goes for draft, that goes for free agency. He may say, you know, he may say, look, I'm all for the build and building it the right way, but you gotta bring in some players too, okay? we have to bring in a few guys who can play, you know, along the lines of Jamie Collins types and get them to convince them to stay. I don't know how you'll be able to do that.
Right.
But it could be a case where Jackson says at the end of the year, things have got to change in the power structure, and I need to be more involved in personnel.
Yeah, that would not surprise me at all, and he would be right to do so, by the way, as far as I'm concerned. Dennis Manilov covering the Browns out there in Cleveland. The historic or potentially historic winless season continues, 0-11 now. Dennis, thanks for the time, my friend. We'll talk again soon.
By the way, my man Matthew Stafford, another fourth quarter comeback.
6-4, looking good at the top of the NFC North. That's what the Lions are. Thank you, brother. All right, there you go. There's Dennis Manilov. College football coming up next as we continue this Monday afternoon quarterback edition of the Extravaganza. Bill Conley, SBNation.com, college football writer. We'll talk about the game. The table has been set. Buckeyes, Wolverines on Saturday. We'll get into that coming up next right here on the Ticket.
Obviously, these are not good times. But again, I thought our guys in the first half, I thought they fought hard. I thought the defense did a good job of keeping them out of the end zone. I didn't think we played well on offense at all. I think we got to get better, and I take responsibility for that. We got to make more plays. We got to do a better job of finding a way to score. You know, this part of the season, there's some things that I thought maybe we start getting better at, and it looks like we're still not there yet. We still got a ways to go, and I know that, and I can see it.
Stafford takes the snap, goes on the end around to Ebron, to the one, to the end zone, touchdown Detroit Lions. Why not? He took it all the way down there, and then he took it home. The Lions have the lead back. 8 seconds to go, maybe the final play of the game. Bortles has got it, sets in the pocket, throws over the middle. It is behind his intended receiver and picked off. The Lions have it. They slide down. It is Tavon Wilson with the ball. Put it away, folks. Win number 6 for the Lions.
On offense, we're, you know, just struggling for yards all game. Struggling for yards, big plays, first downs, whatever it was. So we didn't play as well as we can on offense. Luckily, it's a team game, and our defense and our special teams played fantastic. You know, really helped us out with a win.
Davion Smith breaking tackles inside the 10-yard line. Smith dives. He's in. Touchdown, Michigan.
Checking to make sure that Smith did, in fact, cross the plane. Very clear that he is in the end zone.
Winning a football game is a great feeling. When you're a team and you come together and you go out and win a football game, that's a good feeling enough. Everything's a test. You know, every week is a test. Every game that you line up is a test. I mean, there's a lot of tests in lives. And life comes in many forms and fashions. Playing a really good Indiana football team, that was a huge test for us today. When responding, coming together as a team, gives us a great feeling. We're going to enjoy this game and get right on in preparation for Ohio State.
And it looks like they may be going for two. Tyler O'Connor in the shotgun gets the snap. Back to throw. O'Connor looks, throws in the end zone, and it's intercepted. Chris Worley comes up with it. His second pick of the game as he stepped in front of it. The two-point try no good, and Ohio State remains ahead by just a point, though, 17-16. O'Connor assembles the offense in a hurry. Hits the ball. Drops it as two to pass. Hit while throwing one up the right side of the field, and it's intercepted. Ohio State comes up with another pick on a ball that was thrown up the right side. And with a minute 30 to play, the Buckeyes defense comes up with another takeaway.
Tough day of the office right there. Take the win against a team that we know very well. On the road in November, 10-1, and get ready for a rivalry week.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Tough day at the office. That is an understatement by Urban Meyer, the head coach of the number two college football playoff committee ranked Ohio State Buckeyes. A tough day at the office. They needed to stop a two-point conversion just to get out of East Lansing with a victory. And they have indeed set up rivalry week. Rivalry week really doesn't need to be set up most years, but especially this year. Number two versus number three, Michigan playing for the East Championship, East Division Championship of the Big Ten, and a spot in the Big Ten Championship game and a potential playoff spot. The Buckeyes just playing for a playoff spot. Essentially, if they win, and Penn State, of course, wins, the Buckeyes just have to sit and wait and hope that they don't get dropped down out of their number two, or who knows, will they be lower come Tuesday when the new playoff rankings are announced after just that one-point win over a pretty bad, even though a rival and a conference rival, Michigan State team. If they're lower, could they potentially be bumped out of a spot in the playoffs by the eventual Big Ten champion, whomever that might be? Joining us now to talk a lot about college football, especially in the Big Ten, is Bill Conley with SBNation.com, college football writer extraordinaire. Bill, how are you this afternoon?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being back with us. We always appreciate your insight and your analysis. All right, let's try to make some sense out of what we saw. First, we're going to start right where I just kind of led in with the Ohio State and Michigan games, because they are numbers two and three in the college football playoff. Alabama had a, you know, kind of a ho-hum victory. I don't think we have to talk too much about the Crimson Tide and where they stand. What did you take away, and what do you suspect, Bill, that the college football playoff committee will take away from that one-point victory at East Lansing?
I mean, on one hand, it's Michigan State, and clearly this is just a weird matchup that, you know, Mark D'Antonio has a really good read on how to frustrate JT Barrett and Ohio State. So, I mean, in theory, it doesn't have to mean a whole lot, and the committee doesn't have to look at it a whole lot. Plus, you know, we know that the committee is not really going out of its way to look at things like scoring margin or anything like that. So in theory, that means a 1-point win isn't that much worse than a 40-point win. So it is going to be kind of interesting to see, though. If they're number two this week, then you have to figure they're in no matter what if they beat Michigan. They're not going to – it'd be – you know, it would be a pretty impressive gymnastics act for them to then fall out, fall three spots and out of the playoff race. If they fall to third, though, you know, you could at least talk yourself into them being in some trouble and have the, you know, maybe the committee overthinking and putting Penn State or you know, two-loss Penn State or Wisconsin if the occasion strikes, if everything works out just right. So I don't know. If they're number two, though, I can't see them as anything but safe.
Yeah, I can certainly say that if they do stay at two, or certainly see that if they do stay at two. But if they do drop down to three, let's suppose for a second they drop down to three, just based on the committee's, you know, their feelings. I mean, you know, they're human too. They're allowed to say, you know, they should have won that game by more, even though they say there's no template that all 13 committee members follow. One
right.
may believe that scoring margin doesn't matter, but another one might say, yeah, maybe not scoring margin, but just by dominance of victory or how well you controlled that game. And that game was not really in control all afternoon long against a team with only three wins. So it may kind of make a few of them, you know, chip the Buckeyes just a little bit and knock them down. So if they do go down to number three, and let's say they have a win over Michigan that is or isn't necessarily very impressive, and then you do have that scenario we have discussed for the last couple of weeks, a Penn State win, a Penn State victory over Wisconsin, another top 10 team in the college football playoff rankings in a potential Big Ten championship game. How then does the committee say, yeah, Penn State, we know you won the East that Ohio State was in. We know that you won the Big Ten conference that Ohio State was in. And we know you beat Ohio State head to head, but enjoy your bowl game because Ohio State's going to the playoff.
You know, I try not to put too much stock in conference titles. I know the committee does, or they say they do, or some of them do, or whatever.
Exactly. That's the thing. Some do, some don't. Everybody's got their own criteria. That's the weird part about it.
I think that all of them would have to have that as a criteria, as an important criteria, the conference title thing. Otherwise, I just don't see it happening. Right now, you know, if we can kind of project forward right now, let's say that nothing really changes in the top four. Louisville falls, so now, what, Washington 5, Wisconsin 6, Penn State 7, Oklahoma 8. We'll say something like that.
Okay.
I don't see it, especially if Ohio State's number two. But the other thing is, if Ohio State's number three this week, it's probably behind Michigan, right? I mean, I guess technically they could say Clemson has another win over an above 500 team or whatever, but that would be absurd to bump Clemson ahead of Ohio State and Michigan because they beat Wake Forest.
Agreed.
So, you know, if that's the case, then you're looking at a situation where the winner of Ohio State Michigan is the default too, and Ohio State's safe again.
Yeah, that very well could be the case. You know, but as I look at the AP top 25 and where it stands right now, and you just kind of ran down some of that. Now, this isn't the CFP, the college football playoff rankings, but just the AP and the coaches polls. You know, you got Wisconsin sitting there at 5-1 and 6 in the other, and Penn State at 8 in both of them. Again, you're right. You know, in some people's minds, the conference championship may play a bigger role in deciding who's in the playoffs and who is not. But I just kind of have to believe it's not just like, you know, hey, it was only the conference championship, but it's all of the above. It's they're a top eight team, you know, talking about Penn State. And if they beat Wisconsin, they would certainly be much higher than that in the final polls. But it's a top eight, top five, whatever team they're going to be, in addition to that conference title, in addition to the head-to-head matchup. It's when you do get closer to apples, you know, it's not like if Florida beats Alabama in an upset SEC championship game, that somebody would say, well, Florida deserves the bid over Alabama. Of course not. There's so much of a difference between them. But in a case like this, given the circumstances where these teams are ranked, is it that much of a difference? Is it that much of a gap there to say that, you know, this is a no-brainer, Penn State? I'm sorry, you're on the outside looking in.
I mean, the other part of the Penn State thing is, in this scenario where they end up winning the Big Ten title and Ohio State finishes 11-1, doesn't make the title game, Ohio State did beat them, did beat the team, Michigan, that crushed Penn State earlier in the year. So that's, you know, that takes away some of the head-to-head effect, I think. And B, Ohio State didn't lose to Pitt. I mean, I really like what this Penn State team has started to do, and I'm really impressed with their reliability. I'm almost as impressed with what they've done since the Ohio State game as I was them beating Ohio State. You know, they've turned into a really strong team here down the stretch. They still lost to Penn State. They still got rocked by Michigan. I still think that matters. I think that having one loss versus two matters, especially when there's not a dramatic difference in strength of schedule. It would drive me crazy if they bumped down Ohio State simply because of the conference title game. So we'll see.
In my estimation, Bill, it wouldn't just be because of that, but then you do have the head-to-head. You notice that's why I'm not making the argument for Wisconsin. If Wisconsin were to beat Penn State or Michigan in the conference title game, and Ohio State's, you know, not even a part of that thing, I wouldn't say it because you're talking about two very closely ranked teams. Right now, they're 2-5. Ohio State 2 and Wisconsin 5, just in the AP poll. And now head-to-head plays a big factor there. And guess what? Ohio State beat Wisconsin at Camp Randall. So discussion over. It's Ohio State spot. Penn State only has that argument that I'm making for them, and I have no reason to argue for Penn State other than just for the conversation. I don't root for them in any alliance. But because they are closely ranked, and in this case it's 2-8, and by the time Penn State were to win a hypothetical Big Ten championship game against Wisconsin, they're probably 5. I would imagine no lower than, and now we're talking about Ohio State and Penn State at 2-5 or 3-5, depending on where they land. And now I got to say head-to-head does matter. Who should get the edge over the other one? It probably should matter. And that's what Penn State would have to say for itself.
Yeah, I mean, Penn State, that would certainly be part of Penn State's case. There's no question. I would just think that them losing to Pitt and getting rocked by Michigan would balance that out. I always think of head-to-head as kind of overrated, and you think about a game like Clemson-Louisville that was basically decided by the margin of a home field advantage. I get a little queasy if we get down to that level with it. I think Ohio State's been a top-five team this year, and Penn State's been a top-ten team. And probably won't change, especially because, I mean, I think Ohio State will have to look good to beat Michigan, among other things.
Let's talk about Michigan and how they looked against Indiana. 20-10 was the final. It's one of those games where you don't really put a whole lot of stock into the final score, given the conditions there. We all saw a lot of the games were played in snow and ice and frigid temperatures and high winds across the country. This was one of them. And they got it done with the backup quarterback, although not because of that backup quarterback. I remember going into the regular season when Jim Harbaugh made the decision of Wilton Spade over John O'Korn. He said that it was neck and neck. I mean, it was literally 1A and 1B. It was very, very hard to do because they were both so impressive. Didn't look that way, at least in this particular circumstance, as far as the Michigan passing game. What was your takeaway from Michigan in that win over Indiana, and how prepared do you think they'll be if O'Korn has to go against the Buckeyes at the Horseshoe Saturday?
Yeah, I mean, whether it's O'Korn or Speed, I'm not, either way, I'd be a little nervous if I were Michigan right now, because for me, the most important thing here is that their two worst offensive performances of the year have come in the last 2 weeks. And yeah, the conditions were certainly not friendly on Saturday. And among other things, they also ran the ball relatively well. I mean, what Devion Smith had almost 7 yards per carry, I think. So, you know, maybe that's a good sign. And if the weather's okay, well, even if the weather's not okay, maybe they'll be able to run the ball a little bit. I think against Ohio State, your best opportunity is running versus passing. It's going to be really hard for whichever quarterback who is behind center for Michigan. It's going to be really hard for them to kind of generate a lot of high quality play through the air. So they're going to have to run the ball. And maybe that in those conditions with a iffy quarterback, the fact that they were still able to run the ball, maybe that's a really good sign for Michigan. I don't know. But, it is, you know, the defense still played its part. You know, this is probably the best defense in the country, at least for the whole season. Over the last month, I would give that advantage to probably Alabama. But they're going to have that. They're going to be able to frustrate JT Barrett. And by all accounts, it just kind of seems like this is one of those games where, you know, mistakes from the quarterback positions, mistakes in the passing game, not necessarily a lack of success, but just a lack of disasters is going to play a humongous role.
Bill Connolly writes about college football for SBNation.com. Of the teams that we would say are in contention for a playoff spot, and I don't know how far down that list you want to go, down to maybe six where Washington is. You know, I would say all the one-loss teams, but Wisconsin is number five. Again, that's just in the AP right now, and they're a two-loss team, which could then open the door for two-loss Oklahoma. Again, we talked about Penn State all the way down through a couple of the others. Of those top contending teams, who had the best weekend?
You know, if you want to get a little weird with it, I'd say Alabama, because now Saban's he got his anger material for Iron Bowl week, so they should be in really good shape this coming week. I swear he does that on purpose. They come out with some terrible game plan to allow that team to hang around so he can yell at his guys. But you know, that's, let's see. Washington kind of did what it needed to do and looked good doing it. Got some style points with the one-handed interception and all that. That was probably a good thing, but I think everybody this week
opponent.
Was just.
That was against a 500 Arizona State team, too. That's why I
right. And yeah, now that they've won, it's below 500, so it doesn't count anymore. Right. These dumb criteria. But, really, this week was about survival. It was about setting up, rivalry week and championship week. Nobody had a humongous test on their hands or was supposed to. Obviously, Ohio State ended up having a heck of a challenge on its hands, but everybody survived, and now we move forward. Really, you could say that Oklahoma had the best week.
That's where
if you
want
to go down
going.
To that. If you want to go down to that
going.
Level.
Because number 14, one loss. I'm sorry, one loss. West Virginia was sitting there,
right.
And people are, you know, Oklahoma doubled them up, 56-28, and this is what they had to do, and what
right.
they have to do against an even bigger challenge now, number 10, Oklahoma State, in the Bedlam game on Saturday, because they don't get to impress in a conference championship game. These are their last chances to impress the judges, if you will, if this were
right.
American Idol. This is their last chance to do that, and against a one loss, 14th ranked team, the way that they did, that's a pretty doggone big statement, I thought, by the Sooners.
Right. I think it's got to be too little too late. And actually, I have a really good friend who's an OU fan. He's like, yeah, I don't want any part of the playoff. We'll get killed. We're not a top four team this year. I just want to finish 10-2 and win a bowl. That's all I want. So yeah, I would say it's probably too little too late for them. But if they have any chance whatsoever, they had to rock West Virginia, and now they have to do the same thing to Oklahoma State, and they very well could. I think Oklahoma State is coming off of now one of its best performances of the season, but for the year as a whole, Oklahoma's been the better team here, and I think that the odds favor them in the Bedlam game too. So that, if you want to go down to that level, if you consider Oklahoma still at least a slight contender, you'd probably have to say they had the best week. Colorado too, if we want to even go down even further.
Yeah, Colorado cracks the top 10 now, at least in the AP and in the coaches poll, number 9 in both. And by the way, how much more does that make Michigan's resume? How much more does that enhance Michigan's resume? Again, wins over number 5, Wisconsin, number 8, Penn State, and number 9, Colorado. 3 of the top 10 in the AP top 25, and 3 of the top 7 or 8 or 9 or whatever it's going to be tomorrow night when the CFP comes out. That really says a lot about, you know, the kind of, you know, year Michigan has had, even though they might not have that one win like Ohio State and Norman against the Sooners. They have 3 extraordinarily high quality wins against 3 of the best teams in the country.
Yeah, and every time Penn State looks good, their whatever it was, 49-10, that win looks better.
Right.
And so, you know, it is funny. Like, it seems like people it was programmed in the offseason that their schedule was terrible. And nobody really noticed, wait, they actually have a lot of really good wins until like a couple of weeks ago. But, no, Michigan's been awesome. My concern with Michigan is that they really have, whichever quarterback, they've had 2 bad offensive performances in a row, or at least their 2 worst offensive performances in a row, even with their run success against Indiana. They were humming. They were on paper as good as Alabama until about 2 weeks ago. Now they're more of a one-dimensional team, and that's a little scary. They have to, when you think about, they were already kind of the lesser known entity here when you just talk about Urban Meyer and Ohio State. It's easy to trust that Ohio State's going to play really well on Saturday because we saw it last year. Michigan, I was already a little concerned about in that regard, and then their offense has been a little issue. So I think I trust Ohio State more at this point.
We're 19 minutes into a conversation, Bill Conley of SBNation.com, and we have not talked about the former number 5 team in the CFP rankings last week. They had a chance again to go on national television and show everybody, hey, we belong in that top 4. What in the world happened to Louisville? Is Houston that good? Or is Louisville is Louisville that overrated? Or was this just one of those nights where it was a perfect storm of events that made them look worse than they really are?
Yeah, it's funny how teams that play against an underdog Tom Herman squad tend to get rocked and tend to look terrible. I think Houston had a lot to do with it. They had the perfect game plan, and they had the perfect ability to execute that game plan. They had the right pieces to take advantage of Louisville. Louisville has been defensively, Louisville has been massively underrated, I think, this season. They've been very good defensively, and they only gave up like 4.5 yards per play against Houston, I think, but they were able to invade the backfield repeatedly. At times this year, Louisville has had to call on Lamar Jackson to do absolutely everything, because his receivers are dropping passes, because his offensive line is kind of shaky all of a sudden. That's what happened again the other day, and he couldn't do it. He got sacked 11 times. It was just too much to ask. So I think that was a good game plan and a good ability to pinpoint Louisville's weakness and take full advantage. Louisville's been awesome this year. In terms of pure upside, they've shown about as much as anybody not named Alabama or Ohio State or maybe Michigan, but they've been inconsistent. You've seen their offense kind of go up and down based on the receiving core, based on the offensive line, and it just all piled up against them the other day.
Did Lamar Jackson lose his stranglehold on the Heisman, or is it still his?
I think you could say he lost his stranglehold on it, but I still think, you know, among other things, we don't really know. There hasn't been like a single candidate that has come up like waiting to pounce. You could say maybe Jabril Peppers has, but I think his lead was so big that it's still relatively significant. If he comes out and has one of his, you know, whatever, 200 and 100 games against Kentucky, I think the award's his, and I'm fine with that. I think he's been incredible this year.
On the other hand, if Jabril Peppers returns a kick for a touchdown and
right.
is picked and does the Heisman throws the way Desmond Howard and Charles Woodson both did the last 2 times Michigan guys won the Heisman, then maybe we got a conversation there.
That's right. And then he would also, you know, assuming he does that and they win, right. then he would have another opportunity to do it against Wisconsin, I guess, in the title game, and that would give him another his way to have the last statement. But again, I think if Jackson just plays well against Kentucky and puts up Jackson numbers, he's good.
From your previous comments in this conversation, Bill, it sounds like you are favoring the Buckeyes at home against Michigan on Saturday. But just to set it up, as I get your official prediction today, or no, beg your pardon, tomorrow. Marks the 30th anniversary of Jim Harbaugh's final regular season game at Michigan. It was at Ohio State, and it was a 26-24 win. He says he has not been back to that building since that day. He has not been back inside the horseshoe. And that was the game he guaranteed, quote, I guarantee it, we will beat Ohio State and be in Pasadena on January 1st. So this is the 30th anniversary of that one, and now he's the head coach, and he's got another 10-1 team. Does he go in there and get it done? I think I know your answer, but I'll ask for an explanation.
Until about 2 weeks ago, I would have said yes, but I do at this point have concerns about their offense. And you know, again, if they run the ball well, maybe maybe they're good because their defense really is tremendous. But like I said, I think it comes down to trust for me, and I trust that Ohio State's going to play an A or B plus type of game because it's an Urban Meyer team in a big game against Michigan. But Michigan has more burden of proof for me, so it wouldn't be all that surprising. Obviously, they're a tremendous team, but I think I just trust Ohio State a little bit more.
Yeah, and then they've got the experience too, obviously. You know, some of these guys were on that team that won the championship 2 years ago, so they know what this is like. And Michigan has been down, obviously, during the Brady Hoke years and the Rich Rod years and so on. So there's nobody there that's experienced anything quite of this magnitude yet. So I would agree that's certainly in the Buckeyes' favor. Bill Conley, breaking down college football like nobody else does. Bill, you're a great guest. We always appreciate you come on. We enjoy the writing, but we certainly enjoy the conversation as too. Keep up the great work at SB Nation.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. Bill Conley joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Great stuff. Follow his work on SBNation.com, as I mentioned, and not chime in, I guess. Here's what I want to do. The last couple segments of the program, or the last segment of the program, is on the other side of this break. We're going to get a quick timeout for a sports center, and then I want to fill it up with you. It's Ohio State, and it's Michigan, and it's the week. It is the game. It is everything that we had hoped it could be. Number two, the only thing that could make it better is 1 versus 2, which we had a few years ago. But obviously, number 2 versus number 3, playoffs on the line potentially for the Buckeyes, their last chance to impress. I mean, outside of a Penn State stunning loss, which will not happen, this is the last game Ohio State has before the playoffs. That's just it. They understand that. This is their last chance to impress the playoff committee. And Michigan, of course, needs to win to have yet another chance to impress the committee and maybe get the number 2 slot potentially in the playoffs. So this is about as big as it gets. If you're an Ohio State fan, tell me why the Buckeyes win. If you're a Maize and Blue fan, tell me how Harbaugh goes back into Ohio State and gets it done 30 years later. Again, you tell me at 866-240-1065. We'll talk about it together right here on ESPN 106.5.
To the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
We like to call it Monday Afternoon Quarterback right here on The Ticket every Monday afternoon after a great weekend of college and professional football. Also high school football on Fridays. We are now down into the state semifinals. And a number of teams are still involved from Northwest Ohio and even up into the Michigan high school ranks as well. So we got a lot to get into. And if you are a Michigan fan and you still think that your Wolverines have a shot in Columbus at the Horseshoe without Wilton Spate playing, I want to hear your argument. I was trying to come up with one myself for you when I was talking to Bill Conley. From SB Nation last segment, who sounded very, very skeptical of the Wolverines' chances. He said 2 weeks prior, he might have felt a lot differently about it 2 weeks ago, that maybe Michigan would have been the favorite to go into Ohio State and take down the Buckeyes. But the last 2 weeks, they have had their two worst offensive performances of the year. And you might say, well, the conditions, as Bill talked about it, the conditions against Indiana were pretty bad on Saturday. You can't really, you know, put a whole lot of points up in snowstorms and heavy winds, swirling winds and all that other stuff. Understood. But that was not the case the week before. You could also say that the backup quarterback, John O'Korn, certainly impacted the game. Without John O'Korn, if you'd have had Wilton Spate in there, well, then clearly they would have put up bigger numbers against Indiana and the offense would look much better. Except that wasn't the case the week before. The Iowa loss, 14-13, exposed a lot, I think, about the Michigan offense, that they do not have a very reliable, balanced attack. There have been games when Wilton Spate has put up huge numbers and Jay Huchesson and Jake Butt and the boys were just out there catching all kinds of balls and really looking like a high-powered, high-octane offense. Other games where it looks like, man, this team can really, really run the ball very effectively, as they did Saturday, I beg your pardon. But not very often have we seen them look very balanced where they're doing both. And I think that's what they have to be. And they were exposed a little bit against Iowa 2 weeks ago. And then, again, given all of the circumstances against Indiana, a kind of a lackluster 20-10 win, I understand exactly what Bill Conley means when he says this is not something now, today, I would say, where I think Michigan has much of a chance. 2 weeks ago, definitely. Today, not so much. And I would agree with that. Now, if you are a Michigan fan, maybe your argument is, yeah, but look at Ohio State. They didn't exactly blow Michigan State's doors off either in a 17-16 win in which they looked kind of lackluster. And that's a good argument, too. So that's what I want to do in this segment until 5 o'clock. If you're an Ohio State fan, tell me why you win. If you're a Michigan fan, tell me why you win on Saturday at the Horseshoe. Tony in Perrysburg is up first. Tony, you're on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, how are you, sir?
I am wonderful, Bob. And guess what? You got a Michigan fan right off the bat, buddy.
All right, that's good. That's good. Let me hear it. Lay out the case.
I got to put a nix to this cheerleading you guys are doing for them Buckeyes. You guys might as well have pom-poms and miniskirts on now.
Hey, you heard me trying to make a case for Michigan. I was trying to make a case to Bill Conley about it, for crying out loud.
They were as lackluster Saturday as Michigan was. The only difference is Michigan won by 10, they won by 1. All right. Now, here's why Michigan's going to win it.
Hey, before you go on, real quick. Did you watch the Ohio State-Michigan State game?
I did not. I was at the Michigan game, so I couldn't.
Oh, you were at it. Okay. I was just wondering, and I'll ask some other people this question, too. I'm still trying to figure out why Mark D'Antonio went for two when there was 4:41 to play.
I heard that, too, and I didn't get it, especially when you're at home.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I kicked that that extra point, and it's 17-17, and let's play on, knowing we do have overtime in college football. I think I would have made sure we at least had an even game there with 4.5 minutes left to play. I don't want to have to come back from down one and then kicking off with 4.5 minutes to play. I didn't like that call by Mark D'Antonio, but anyway, go ahead.
Now here's why Michigan wins, and you can argue with me as soon as you want, but position by position, line them up. Michigan's got a better team, except for at quarterback. I'll give you guys Barrett. He's a beast. But that's it. Running back, Michigan's got the advantage. Offensive line, Michigan's
got the
advantage.
Whoa. Why do you so casually say that De'Veon Smith is better than Mike Weber?
What?
And Curtis Samuel.
I wasn't saying Smith. I was saying running back. We got four of them. And they will run. That's why Harbaugh lost the Iowa game. That and a phantom face mask call. But because he didn't stick to what they knew. Feed the beast. Keep running the ball, the ball.
Okay, so you think they have a better running game than Ohio State. Who has the better – see, you know, it's interesting when you say if we go position by position. Hold on. Position by position is one thing, but let's take it instead of position by position. Let's take it as a whole. The offense – is the Michigan offense as high-powered and explosive and can score as much against a good defense as the Ohio State offense is, unit?
I think they've shown that. I think they've shown that. Other than the last 2 weeks, which I'll give Acorn a pass because last week, I don't care who you weren't throwing the ball in that wind. I was there. I know how much it was blowing. You weren't throwing the ball accurately in that win.
I might give you that, but I'm just looking at, for example, you know, the Michigan offense against Iowa. You didn't have that wind, and you had Wilton Spate. And I'm looking at the Michigan. I'm looking at the Week 5 win that Michigan had over Wisconsin, 14-7. Again, that was a home game. You weren't able to muster the 14 points. I just see against really good defenses or defenses with really good game plans. I see an inconsistent Michigan offense where I see a lot more high-powered dynamic stuff from
Ohio
State.
Where was that in the Penn State game?
What's that?
Where was that high-powered offense in the Penn State game?
I didn't say they were the perfect offense. I think they're more high-powered than Michigan's.
Well, where was that in the Michigan game?
Well, against Michigan State, it was very similar to what Michigan just played in against Indiana. You know the conditions and you know the circumstances. Not to mention, and I think Bill Conley said it right, and I don't know how you explain it, but there is something going on where Mark D'Antonio seems to kind of know Urban Meyer very well and knows JT Barrett really well and kind of just knows how to defend those guys. Michigan State is kind of the outlier there. They kind of have Ohio State's number for whatever reason.
Okay. Is home field worth 30 points? Because that was the difference between Penn State and Ohio State and Penn State and Michigan.
Well, no, you can't do that. But you know what I do think? I do think home field is worth at least a touchdown in this game. And that touchdown is going to be the difference.
Now, defensively, I don't think you can argue whatsoever that Michigan's got the advantage.
I would agree. Michigan's defense is one of the best in the country. They're a very, very good defense. However, they are not unbeatable. They are, you know, they did give up 23 to a very, very underwhelming Michigan State team. And they did give up 28 to Colorado, which we now know is a lot better than people realized in week 3.
That's not that bad of a win, is it?
No, it's not. It's a very impressive win, as I said earlier on, especially the 45 that they put up against Colorado, now number 9 in the country and a 2-loss team. But you know, Michigan's defense is one of the best in the country. There's no doubt about that. But I think Ohio State has enough weapons where they can put some points up against that team.
It's the best in the country. It's not one of the best. It's the best. Look at the numbers. Number 1 in everything. It's the best defense in the country.
I don't know. I still like in a head-to-head matchup, and you can't do head-to-head this way, but I mean, playing the same offenses against as one another, I still might like Alabama's talent, which has probably 5 or 6 first-round picks on their defense over Michigan, maybe. That's why I'll give them one of the best. And even if you do say the best, that doesn't necessarily mean it's good enough to stop an Ohio State team that if the conditions are right, they can beat you on the ground and they can beat you in the air just as equally. And I don't know if Michigan can do that, especially without Spate.
Oh, I disagree. I've been to the games. I saw them put up huge numbers just like Ohio State did. And I've seen them not perform on the offensive side, just like Ohio State does.
So what's your prediction?
To me,
the score?
That's a wash. The offenses are a wash.
So what's the score then for you?
For me? Well, you didn't let me make my last point, and that was the game changer is going to be Peppers against J.T. Barrett. J.T. Barrett can outrun every other linebacker in the Big Ten and probably in the country other than Peppers. He's the one guy who will be able to catch him. So if Peppers has a good game.
Are you suggesting that Peppers is going to spy on Barrett?
Oh, I'd almost guarantee it.
If you do that, then you're going to lose. If you do that, you're going to lose. And the reason why is you cannot afford to have your best defensive player so focused on one guy that you ignore Curtis Samuels and that he ignores
Mike Weber. They're not ignored. You got the two of the best corners in the Big Ten.
Yeah, well, if you're counting on your corners to be your leading tacklers there instead of your best defensive player and your best tackler, Peppers, then I think you got a problem. You can't afford to keep Peppers spying on Barrett all game long and saying you're going to have to chase that
biggest threat on the field?
Who has been the biggest playmaker for the Buckeyes in the last four weeks of football? It's been Samuels. It's been Curtis Samuels. That is a big, big game changer in this game. Don't think that if you stop Barrett, you stop the Buckeyes.
Samuels has been the home run hitter. They can stop the run without Peppers.
Okay.
They've proven it. They can plug the middle. It's hard to run on Michigan.
I know it is, but that's in large part because of Peppers. If you take Peppers and just kind of make him a specialist player where you're just kind of in charge of stopping one guy, I'm telling you, that's a big, big gap.
He's not in charge of stopping one guy. He's just in charge of keeping an eye on that guy.
So how does Michigan score against this Ohio State defense if you have a Corn playing quarterback?
Well, they're going to have to run the ball and run the ball hard. And I don't think Ohio State can stop them.
I don't know.
I haven't seen anybody who, when Michigan's committed to running the ball, who can stop them from running the ball.
All I know is Nebraska runs the ball pretty doggone well, and Ohio State held them to 3 points. That's when they were number 10 in the country, by the way.
Nebraska's not Michigan.
I know
that's
that.
What I got to get. I mean, everybody's been high on the Buckeyes, and I really don't see why. They've been just as mediocre on offense.
No, nothing else. I disagree, especially when you look at, and here's the other factor, you know, you can go position, and by the way, I really appreciate the good debate, it's fun. You can go position by position like you wanted to do and unit for unit, et cetera, et cetera, and that's fine. But there is the impact of experience and big game performance. And as I said to Bill Conley, none of the Wolverines on this team right now have been in anything even close to what many of these Buckeyes have been through, and that is the playoffs. That is the playoffs and a national championship. The Wolverines are so not used to being in this kind of a game, and I don't mean the rivalry, the big game, but just in this kind of a magnitude with playoffs and Big Ten championships on the line. The Buckeyes have lived with the Big Ten championships
since Urban Meyer
got there. They've lived with the Big Ten championship, and they, of course, lived with the national championship 2 years ago. That experience has to account for a lot.
Not these Buckeyes. Remember, offensive, defensive line are young. young.
They're young, but they were there. They were there, even if they were only sophomores in the national championship game two years ago. They were there. This is a very, very deep, experienced team.
We'll all find out Saturday.
Yes, indeed. Great call, my friend. I appreciate it. Really good conversation. By the way, looking at the statistics, he's right about Michigan rushing the football, second only to Ohio State in the Big Ten. Ohio State rushes for 263 yards a game average. Michigan, 235. Nebraska, that I was talking about, 186, sixth in the Big Ten, if you are scoring that at home. So, yeah, I mean, there's a reason why, as I look at all of the statistics, scoring offense, Ohio State 1, Michigan 2. Scoring defense, Michigan 1, Ohio State 2. Total offense, Ohio State 1, Michigan 2. They are at the top of virtually every single statistic in the Big Ten this year. There's a reason why they are two of the top three teams in the country. It's going to be fun. All right, this was a fun conversation. I enjoyed every bit of it as much as I will enjoy tomorrow's. If you come back, we'll do it all over again. But for now, stay where you are. Drive Time is coming your way right here on the Ticket.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.